Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll look into a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with one of the leading experts on U.S.-Russian relations, Angela Stent, who served as an advisor on Russia under Bill Clinton and George W. Bush and maintains close ties with key policymakers in both countries. We'll examine the crisis over Russia's annexation of Crimea and the likelihood of worsening relations between the two former rival Cold War superpowers, and discuss her new book, The Limits of Partnership, U.S.-Russian Relations in the 21st Century, which is an inside look into the recent post-Cold War history of Presidents Clinton, Bush, and Obama's dealings with Russia under Boris Yeltsin and Vladimir Putin. Then finally, we'll examine the deepening rift between Qatar and its Arab neighbors, Saudi Arabia, the UAE, Kuwait, and Bahrain, as well as Egypt. Toby Jones, a professor of history at Rutgers University and author of Desert Kingdom, How Oil and Water Forged Modern Saudi Arabia, joins us to discuss conflict within the Six-Nation Gulf Cooperation Council, which mirrors a larger Middle Eastern struggle over systems of governance that has been playing out across the region since the Arab Spring. Joining us now in studio is Angela Stent, the director of the Center of Eurasian, Russian, and East European Affairs and a professor of government and foreign affairs at Georgetown University. She's also a senior fellow at the Brookings Institution and co-chairs the Hewitt Forum on Post-Soviet Affairs. From 2004 to 2006, she served as National Intelligence Officer for Russia and Eurasia at the National Intelligence Council. And from 1999 to 2001, she served in the Office of Policy Planning at the United States Department of State. She's the author of the new book, The Limits of Partnership, U.S.-Russian Relations in the 21st Century. Welcome to Background Briefing, Angela Stent.
Well, delighted to be here.
And I suppose in many ways that moment with Sergei Lavrov, the foreign minister of Russia in Geneva back in 2009, with Secretary of State Hillary Clinton giving him the gift box with the button inside that was said in Russian, supposedly it said reset, but Lavrov corrected her and said actually it means overload. And of course, in many ways, that accident ends up being somewhat prophetic, wouldn't you say?
Definitely. The mistranslation by whoever did it in the U.S. government was indeed prophetic. And in fact, the next day after she'd given that button to Sergei Lavrov, a major Russian newspaper published an article under the headline, Clinton and Lavrov Pushed the Wrong Button. But on the other hand, I would say in the first Obama term, things worked quite well with Russia. And they really started to become unraveled when Mr. Putin announced that he was going back to the Kremlin.
So what happened, though, seems to have soured that relationship with Libya, wasn't it? And my understanding is that also that soured Putin's relationship with Medvedev.
Yes, I think that's true. I think that Medvedev, for whatever reason, decided that Russia would abstain on that crucial vote that allowed the no-fly zone and then led to the downfall of Gaddafi. And clearly, almost immediately afterwards, Mr. Putin came out and talked about crusades and people marching into places and deposing people. I've been part of a group for the last 10 years, and we've met every year with Mr. Putin. We've had dinner with him. And I remember when he described what happened to Gaddafi the next year when we met with him. And he was really, you could see on his face that he found this outrageous and really thought it was shocking that that had happened. So that certainly soured it. And I think a number of people believe that that was when he openly broke, if you like, with Mr. Medvedev, although that's not what he said. He said all along they were going to switch places. So I think we don't know the truth about that yet.
So that leads me to, I guess, the 900-pound gorilla in the room question. Is there a subtext to what happened to Gaddafi and then what happened to Yanukovych and that it could happen to him? Is that what's going on here?
I think a theme throughout his presidency, well, particularly following the first color revolution in Georgia in 2003, and particularly when there was a color revolution in 2004 in Ukraine, he has come to believe that the United States is in the business of regime change. He looks at the Iraq War. He looks at these color revolutions. He looks at what happened in Libya. He looks at what's happening now in Ukraine. And he thinks that the U.S. is out to impose governments that it favors in different parts of the world, including on his back door. And I think the ultimate concern is the United States' ultimate goal to replace the current regime in Russia.
So, and I'm sure you've done this, you've been with the American delegations trying to dissuade Vladimir Putin. What kind of arguments have you made?
Well, I mean, you know, tries to explain that this is not the U.S. goal, that the U.S. is trying to, if we're talking about Russia's backyard, support the sovereignty and the independence and the viability of these post-Soviet states. But I think that's not how the Kremlin sees it. And it's always been suspicious. I think an anecdote to explain this is during the Ukrainian color revolution in 2004, the Russians put out statements all the time saying that who was behind this color revolution? It was this conjoining of forces between President Bush and George Soros. Now, George Soros, obviously a major financier of NGOs and democracy building in the post-Soviet world, utterly opposed to President Bush, spent a lot of his own money trying to make sure that he was defeated in the 2004 election. But their idea is they will look at these two figures and think that, well, they must actually be in cahoots, showing a total misunderstanding of the way that U.S. politics works.
So if we're trying to, at least in my mind, we're trying to figure out how personal this is or how geopolitical it is, and it's very difficult for me to tell with Putin. But I think in terms of geopolitics, it is pretty clear that NATO is inexorably moved east, has it not? And was that, do you think, a historic mistake, as many have said?
Well, if you go back to the Gorbachev time, right, Mr. Gorbachev believes that a promise was made to the Soviet Union in the time of German unification that NATO would not expand. I wrote my previous book on Soviet-German relations and German reunification, and there were absolutely no written agreements on that. This is maybe what Mr. Gorbachev understood. There was only a promise at the time that NATO troops wouldn't be stationed in the former East Germany. Now, then you fast forward to the Clinton administration, and obviously, this is a controversial issue. On the one hand, and I believe that Poland and the Czech Republic and Hungary and the Baltic states, they had the right to choose what alliance they wanted to be in, given their history and given the fact that they were sort of floating around there, not in any alliance structure. On the other hand, I do think more could have been done to include Russia in and give it a stake in a new Euro-Atlantic security system. I mean, there is a NATO-Russia Council, and there's been one since 1997, but it's not never worked very well. I think the U.S. could also seriously have offered Russia the prospect of NATO membership. And in my book, I describe when I worked in policy planning, we in fact did work on a plan on that. Obviously, it didn't go anywhere. So I wouldn't criticize the enlargement of NATO. I would criticize the lack of imagination or initiative among the NATO partners to offer Russia a deal which would have given it a bigger stake in the stability of this post-Cold War system that we see now unraveling in Crimea.
But could you have had a kind of military vacuum in that? Because after all, the Warsaw Pact disappeared, but NATO didn't. So one would just assume that from the Russian point of view, they either you have a neutral zone in that vacuum or something that they can accept fills it.
Yes, I think the Russians probably hoped that NATO would disband. And they've always said, well, why did you need NATO after 1992? There was no more Warsaw Pact. You didn't need to have two blocks. Or they, you know, had hoped that that zone would be neutral. But the problem is, if you look at history and you look at the history of Russia's relations with the Baltic states, with Poland, also with Czechoslovakia, as it then was, and Hungary, you can understand why those countries feared being, you know, in a neutral zone where they didn't have guarantees from NATO. Of course, the subtext was they wanted those guarantees against future Russian, potential Russian aggression, even though the U.S. and the other sort of traditional, the old NATO members, if you liked, always said, well, no, this is not against Russia. It's just to increase stability here. I think the other subtext of NATO was in order to join all of these countries who'd had lots of ethnic rivalries and where they'd been ethnic cleansing before, they had to promise that they would resolve these issues. And so one good thing I think that joining NATO did was to make sure that, you know, Hungarians and Romanians weren't going to face each other fighting each other. But I think that subtext was probably lost on the Russians.
So just to touch on the current crisis, which could get worse. I mean, some of the stuff that's coming out of the foreign ministry is ominous. They did the same with Crimea. They talked about pogroms against Russian speakers and fascists and anti-Semites rampaging around. Clearly, it wasn't true in Crimea. And it doesn't appear to be true in at least in eastern Ukraine, but that hasn't stopped the propaganda machine from churning out this stuff. My understanding is that Putin is riding high in the polls in Russia. He's never been more popular. Tremendous amount of nationalism, a sense of pride, even macho is going on there. A lonely protester tried to protest in the street, and he was spat on and cursed, and his placard saying no war was ripped from his hands. So I guess the questions again go back to my dilemma. Is this a greater Russian geopolitical move out of a sense of NATO encroachment, or is this President Putin striking out? He saw what happened to Yanukovych, and he doesn't want it to happen to him, and he's distracted the entire Russian people now.
Right. Well, it's all of the above, and you're quite right. His popularity went up 8 points in the last week. He stands now, I believe, around 70%, something that the U.S. president could only dream about. This has been a popular movement at home, domestically. It's revived people's sense of pride in Russia. They look at Crimea, and they understand that Crimea was, of course, traditionally part of Russia. It's majority Russian-speaking, and I think all of the resentments against the West have all come to the fore there. One anecdote on this. In 2008, I taught a class at the Moscow State Institute of International Relations. And these are the elite young people who are going to go into the foreign ministry, the defense ministry, other parts of the Russian government. Not one of these young people born after the Soviet Union collapsed believed that the Soviet Union had collapsed because of its own internal weaknesses. They all believed that this was the result of the actions of the United States and its intelligence services. So if you have even a younger generation that sees somehow that this was a plot, that the Soviet Union collapsed because of a plot, and now if you can reclaim at least part of Ukraine, you're reclaiming really what's rightfully yours. That obviously is really going to increase support for Mr. Putin. And on all of the stories that you hear from Moscow about what's really happening, there's obviously a kernel of truth. Some of the groups in Kiev, out on the square, are extreme right wing, are probably, you know, pro-fascist and are anti-Semites. But that's a very small group. The majority of these people do not share those views, and the majority of the interim government doesn't. But they've been able to sort of whip this up into a frenzy. And you see all the posters, people say in Crimea they're voting against fascism and for Russia. Well, if you present it in terms like that, then it's clear what the answer is going to be. And I think from Mr. Putin's point of view, he was so shocked having offered $15 billion to Mr. Yanukovych and thought that he had a deal with him. He wouldn't sign an agreement with the European Union. He'd move closer to Russia. To see that come unraveled in February, and then to see an agreement signed on February the 21st with the European foreign ministers and his own representative, which would have included Yanukovych until an election in December, and the next day to see him flee. Now, we don't really know why that happened, but that comes back to, you know, your point that if it can happen there, it could happen in Russia too.
But the reason it happened in Ukraine, I think, largely was to do with the disgust at this kleptocracy, this family. The older son, the dentist, was shaking down all of the oligarchs. They stole, 10% of the GDP? Mm-hmm. We don't know how much they stole. And I spoke yesterday to Bill Browder, who knows Russia pretty well. He was the biggest investor in Russia until 2005. And he said that that was a defining moment for Putin, because what Putin's concerned about is that he's going to suffer that same fate because he has even bigger palaces and has stashed away even more money than Yanukovych has.
Well, one can argue about the sums, the figures, but certainly the kind of corrupt regime that existed and still exists in Kiev, in Ukraine, exists in practically all of the post-Soviet space, in all of those countries. And obviously, there are huge questions in Russia, whether the system is, the close relationship between political and economic elites, vast assets, some of them abroad, some of them in Russia. So yes, there would be a concern that if people can unravel and expose the corruption in Ukraine, they could do it in Russia too. And sometimes they've occasionally tried to do it, but so far not successfully.
Well, Navalny came up with the phrase that the party of crooks and swindlers, right? And that has resonated with the intelligentsia, but not with the narod, not with the rest of the country.
I think that's true, because I think exactly the educated urban elites understand that, and they understand that there's a huge scale of corruption. The narod, the people, I mean, they live in a country where you expect everybody wants to take bribes. You don't expect people to be honest. But I think somehow they don't quite believe that there's some huge, massive corruption on the part of the top leadership. And even though exposés come out and people publish things on the internet, and then some of them leave Russia and they publish them in the Financial Times. I think the people who support him probably don't really have exposure to those kinds of reports.
Well, they don't exactly have investigative journalism there. Putin controls the entire press except for Novaya Gazeta.
Right, they don't. And sometimes investigative journalists then, mysteriously get killed. So, yes, it's much harder to expose this kind of thing in Russia because the controls are much tighter than they are in Ukraine.
Well, but what I'm getting at here, Angela Stent, is Putin and Russia have become inextricable. He's he'll be probably the longest serving leader by
2018 is the next election, and if he runs again, he could be there till 2024. Yeah, longer than anyone else.
Right. So the question is, if these rumors, and after all, Masha Gessen wrote a book that was pretty damning, and she actually had a meeting with him in the Kremlin as well. And after listening to Bill Browder yesterday, my head's reeling, the idea that, that perhaps what we have here is what happened, for example, in the great moment of historical appeasement with the Munich meeting between Chamberlain and Hitler. And I'm not suggesting using the word, there's no fascist subtext here that I'm alluding to, but I'm alluding to the fact that Chamberlain was out of the old school British gentleman diplomat, and he simply didn't know that he was dealing with a gangster and a thug. And is it possible that we in the West have been dealing with a gangster and a thug, and because he's the head of a state, et cetera, we sort of gloss over that? Because my sense is that all gangsters crave respect, and we certainly give Putin respect. And the question is, does he deserve it?
Well, I think most Western governments, most Europeans, certainly in the U.S., the people who deal with Russia, they understand what they're dealing with. I don't think we're naive. But I think one thing that's happened is this isn't the Cold War anymore. This is a integrated global economy. And, particularly in Europe, particularly in Great Britain and other European countries, there are huge economic stakes in Russia, as well as Russia obviously having stakes in Europe too. Less so of the United States, but there's still some of that there where you see already groups in the U.S. trying to prevent very tough sanctions from being imposed on Russia. So I think people have a pretty good idea about what they're dealing with. But on the other hand, Russia remains a nuclear superpower. It has a veto in the United Nations Security Council. It has huge reserves of oil and gas. So it really does have levers that it can also exert in the world. It can also make it much more difficult for the U.S. and its allies to achieve some of their goals in other areas, for instance, Iran, Syria, other issues we could talk about. So even though people know what they're dealing with, there are other equities involved in this, and that, I think, restrains or constrains the degree to which one is going to confront Russia.
Even though, in effect, Russia is Putin. Isn't that the problem? I mean, you have just suggested there's more to Russia than Putin, but he seems to be so powerful and have such personal power.
Well, he's not all powerful. He's the single most powerful person in Russia. But the system exists because they're different groups of people, oligarchs, now many from the security services, who support him. And he sort of also is an arbiter between these different groups. And coming back to the question of, what might happen in the future, of course, if the assets of these people are frozen abroad, if they cannot visit countries, visit their mansions in London or whatever, then they might start to rethink, is it really worthwhile? Should we be supporting the system? Because we've done rather well out of it, but we don't want to our assets and our livelihood to be endangered. And that could in the future put some pressure on the system and could maybe lead to change. But that's far off in the future. And so right now, it's in the interests of most of the groups who support Putin to continue supporting him so that they continue to enjoy their lifestyles.
Well, the dissident chess master, Garry Kasparov, said Putin is afraid of banks, not tanks. So I mean, are you making that point?
I think, yes, I think that's true as well. He is a, yeah, I agree. I don't think he fears that anyone's going to come and, you know, no one's going to go to war with Russia. And that's why, though, in since he came back to the Kremlin, he has encouraged all of his supporters there, all of these different kinds of oligarchs, to repatriate their money into Russia because they were quite vulnerable having so many assets abroad. But still many of them do.
We're going to take a brief station break and we'll be back continuing the conversation with Angela Stent. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, and we're continuing our conversation with Angela Stent, who joins me in the studio. So, Angela Stent, again, the author of the new book, The Limits of Partnership, U.S.-Russian Relations in the 21st Century. We talked earlier about Putin's relationship with Obama souring over Libya, and it perhaps affected his relationship with his prime minister, Medvedev, or who was then, of course, president, and they've switched sides, and many people thought that Putin was in charge all along in any case. But just turning to Syria, do you think that Obama was had over Syria? I mean, a lot of people do, that basically the deal we made, only 4% of these chemical weapons have been handed over, and the deal itself ensures Assad's survival because he knows where the chemical weapons are. So it was like a deal that essentially, you know, ensconced Assad, who is indispensable to the deal, but he's also the main cause of the problem.
Well, it's true. I mean, if you look back, first of all, I would just make the point that I think the thing that really ended the reset in the relationship between Obama and Putin was granting Edward Snowden political asylum in Russia. Now, putting that aside, that shortly thereafter, I mean, the problem was that the U.S. government, you know, was unable to make a decision about what to do, as was the British government, because they faced opposition in their legislatures. And so it's I would say it was the hesitation on the part of the U.S. Putin then jumped in. It looked like a face-saving solution. We'll disarm them of their chemical weapons. And now, as you say, that's not working out the way we thought it would. I mean, there was some progress. It now seems to have come to a halt. And since we've now halted, in fact, our own military cooperation with Russia on a number of levels, I don't know how far that will go. Certainly, the Russians have, from the beginning, calculated that Assad would survive, and they're helping him survive by supplying him with all those weapons. And you've heard, you know, a lot of criticism, even before the Crimean events, from Secretary Kerry and President Obama. They may have been had there, but there seemed to be no other way out of this, because on the one hand, you know, there was a possibility of having to use force, having drawn a red line and then stepped back from it on the part of the U.S. administration. But certainly cooperation on Syria right now isn't working.
Well, in turning to your book, Angela Stent, The Limits of Partnership, U.S.-Russian Relations in the 21st Century, start out with George H.W. Bush and the new Russia. But then the real relationship, of course, is your chapter one, The Bill and Boris Show. So there are two questions about that era. One, after spending trillions on winning the Cold War, and obviously, you know, it's a problem to do a victory dance in the end zone. and that's something that has really offended the Russians. But, you know, it felt like we sort of abandoned them. You know, we spent all this money confronting them, and if the strategy was to bankrupt them, then that worked. Why didn't we step in then and secure the victory for democracy and for Russia?
Well, I think one of the criticisms is that there should have been a new Marshall Plan. But if you go back and you talk to, for instance, General Scowcroft, as I have, and the people in the H.W. Bush administration, they will say that the Congress, wasn't interested in that. And one of the themes of my book is that the U.S. Congress has never been interested in the past 22 years in doing very much to help Russia and improve the relationship. It's rather passed legislation that makes it more difficult. So, yes, I mean, you can argue that there should have been much more economic assistance, particularly in the beginning. There was some democracy assistance. Then, of course, you can argue about the economic advice that was given by the U.S., namely supporting shock therapy and this rather difficult transition away from a Soviet-planned economy, which left millions of people impoverished there. And there's a lot of criticism. Maybe the U.S. shouldn't have supported that. There should have been a gradual transition. But I suppose the people who were then in power in Russia really didn't believe that. I think the problem in the 1990s is we did quite a lot domestically in trying to help build democracy in Russia. But then, of course, came the Balkan Wars. And I think one of the very neuralgic parts for Yeltsin, and you see some of that playing out today in Ukraine, is particularly in Kosovo, less so in Bosnia, but Russia was forced to accept an agenda, written in Washington or Brussels, at least, NATO, and go to war, essentially, or support a war against Serbia in the case of Kosovo. And it felt very humiliated by that. And I think that's how that Bill and Boris reset ended, was just over the Kosovo war and Russia feeling that its traditional partner, ally Serbia, its interests had been completely disregarded.
And, of course, that comes up now as an analogy, mm-hmm. that NATO bombed Serbia and Kosovo was a part of Serbia, and yet it was carved off, so therefore it's
became independent.
Yes, so right. We can do the same thing in Crimea.
Right, and exactly that's what they're coming back. Of course, there are lots of analogies. We have a war of words going on at the moment vis-a-vis Ukraine and Crimea, and that people throw analogies around. It's probably not a very good idea to make the analogies, but in the Kosovo case, of course, you could say there was a long period of negotiations. I mean, in the end, the Russians wouldn't agree to support it, but there was a long period of negotiations, and its independence was recognized by a significant number of countries, although obviously not all of them, whereas what's happening in Crimea has been done, at the barrel of a gun, so to speak. But those analogies are always there.
So in terms of the Boris and Bill show, were we too focused on the incredibly remote possibility of communism returning and just sort of turned a blind eye to the oligarchical rampage, the theft of national assets or the appropriation of national mm-hmm. assets and all these overnight billionaires? Because one of the things I understand is towards the end, Yeltsin, having hired Putin, had sort of buyer's remorse at the very end.
Well, we certainly – in 1996, there was an election, right? And Yeltsin's numbers were in the single digits, and it looked as if the communists would win. And it is true that the major focus of the U.S. was that the communists should not come back to power. And in the end, Dick Morris, who'd at one point also advised President Clinton on various election strategies, one of his teams went and advised the Yeltsin team, and so that he went from single digits to winning in the second round of the elections, even though he was really quite ill. By the time Mr. Putin took over, Yeltsin was obviously in ill health, and that's why he resigned prematurely. One does understand from what he subsequently said that he did have some buyer's remorse. But at the time, they believed that Mr. Putin would come in and that he would be, he was orderly, organized, but he wouldn't try and assert himself too much, and there wouldn't be, the system.
He'd be like a technician or a technocrat.
A technician. I mean, you can say, the corrupt system that exists in Russia today began under Yeltsin. It did not begin under Putin. But of course, it was a different group of oligarchs. Yeah, they thought he'd be maybe more of a technician and that he wouldn't clamp down so much domestically as he's done or exert the kind of controls that you can see now.
And in those early days, what was your sense then of George W. Bush looking into his eyes and seeing his soul? I mean, did again we get had, or did the president get had, or did he not see the real soul?
Well, I think when Putin first came in, he had a series of meetings with Western leaders, Europeans and Americans, and he said he wanted Russia to be integrated into the West, to the global economy. He said Russia's a European country. And so in the beginning, people believed that he really meant that. And maybe he really did mean it. I mean, we can argue about that. I think the first time he met President Bush, when President Bush made that remark that he later came to regret in Slovenia, it was his first trip to Europe, President Bush's. He had been derided by most of the major European leaders, including particularly Chancellor Gerhard Schröder. And then he met Vladimir Putin, and Putin was very respectful. He really knew how to handle George Bush, I would say, and talk to him. They talked about religion and various other things. So, but I do think that what Putin believed when he offered, when he was the first foreign leader to call the United States after the terrorist attacks on 9/11 and offer Russia as a partner in the war on terror, I think he really did believe that this would be, as one of the Russians, I quote, describes in my book, an equal partnership of unequals. In other words, the U.S. would treat Russia as an equal, as a strategic partner, that we'd be allies like we were in World War II, where we had a common enemy. And then what disappointed him was, and that worked, you know, for maybe about 6 months in the first phase of the war in Afghanistan, when Russia was an important partner. And then he saw the Bush administration deriding traditional arms control agreements. They weren't interested in that. Then the invasion of Iraq, then the color revolutions, and that all, again, added up to the specter of regime change, not only in Iraq, but in Russia itself. So I think that Putin did have expectations that were then disappointed. They maybe were not expectations that the U.S. understood. But I do believe in the beginning, he did have a hope of having a better relationship with the United States. And that's why I say that that third reset was really inaugurated by him.
Well, just in closing, Angela Stent, your book, The Limits of Partnership, U.S.-Russian Relations in the 21st Century, couldn't be more timely. And my sense is that U.S.-Russian scholarship is going to come back, isn't it? I mean, it may be the worst possible way if things get – we have a new Cold War. But, I mean, I don't mean to be – ironic here, but...
Well, certainly Kremlinology will come back. It probably never died, but in the 90s, you didn't need to, you know, the country was more open, so the kind of Kremlinology and those skills that you had in the Cold War were not needed as much. Certainly, it's coming back now, and I think the danger is that because the Cold War ended and because nobody thought Russia was going to be a problem anymore, we really don't have enough younger people who are trained as experts in this field. Many of us have been doing this for a long time. So I think it's possible that as a result of this crisis, you know, we will understand the need to have more specialists in Russia, you know, who understand as much as they can about how the Kremlin functions and Russia's neighbors too, and to forget that Russia remains a very important country and will remain so for a long time.
Well, let's hope we don't have to read the Kremlin tea leaves what we did in the Cold War. We can actually sit across from them and talk to them. I mean, it does seem that it will be impossible to turn the clock back that much.
Oh, yes. No, I mean, the Soviet Union isn't going to be restored. Russia is a capitalist country of some sort. It's not going to have that kind of closed economy. And even though it does have a pretty authoritarian political system, I mean, the internet is still rather free. There are lots of interesting discussions. You can see there's one radio station where you hear lots of dissenting views. So it's not the Soviet Union. It's not going to be the Soviet Union. People can travel to and from Russia. They have personal freedoms that they never had before. So, you know, and the hope is that will continue. It may take more generations than we thought for Russia to become less authoritarian, but I'm sure eventually it will.
Well, I thank you so much for joining us here today, Angela Stent. Again, I've been speaking with Angela Stent, who's the director of the Center for Eurasian, Russian, and East European Affairs and a professor of government and foreign affairs at Georgetown University. She's also a senior fellow at the Brookings Institution and co-chairs its Hewitt Forum on Post-Soviet Affairs. And from 2004 to 2006, she served as National Intelligence Officer for Russia and Eurasia at the National Intelligence Council. And from 1999 to 2001, she served in the Office of Policy Planning at the United States Department of State and is the author of the new book, The Limits of Partnership, U.S.-Russian Relations in the 21st Century. We're going to take a brief station break, and we'll be back talking about Saudi Arabia's threat to blockade its neighbor, Qatar.